This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl and our last live episode for 2025. I say live because we've got some treats up our sleeve, some little stocking fillers to tide you over until we're back again in 2026. Thank you so much if you are a listener of the podcast, if you've liked, subscribed, if you're a part of our fam, if you've ever asked a question, if you came to our live show earlier this year. We so appreciate it. We love getting to hang out with you every single week and answer your science questions. It's a pleasure to host it. It's a pleasure to hang out with Dr. Carl. I'm Lucy Smith. Let's get into your last questions for the year. We're looking back at the year that was, and we're also wrapping some things up in a neat little bow. Dr. Carl, this is our last episode for the year.
For 2025, which is this amazing year, which is a triangle number.
What do you mean?
Okay, get your pencil and paper. Have you got
I've got it.
Okay,
I've got
right.
It.
Audience, you have to do this too. So firstly, write down number one and put a circle around it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you've done that. And so 2025, which is the year we're in, is equal to 45 squared, which is not that amazing. But let me take you to the second stage. 45, so write down two and put a circle around it. So that's the second thing. Mm-hmm. 45 is equal to 1 plus 2 plus dot, 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 plus 8 plus 9, and that's not that amazing, but then the third one is the kicker. So 45, and then write down number 3 and put a circle around it. 2025 is equal to 1 cubed plus 2 cubed plus dot, 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 8 cubed plus 9 cubed. And these are rare numbers, and they're called triangle numbers.
Hang on, where did you get the 8 from?
Oh, all the way up to 9. So 45 is equal to all the numbers up to 9 added together. And 45 squared is equal to the cubes of all the numbers up to 9 added together. So 45, 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 plus 7 plus 8 plus 9. And 45 squared, or 2025, is equal to 1 cubed plus 2 cubed plus 3 cubed, 4 cubed, 5 cubed, 7, 8, 9, 10, 9 cubed. I know this is highly unoriginal and only a very small number of nerds will love this, but I'm one of them.
Okay. I can't do this. Maths, it's too much.
Okay, let's go to frogs.
Okay. Now, we had a question in October.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kirsten sent this one in and it's kind of gotten some great responses on the podcast, but also you've had some people get in contact with you about it. So Kirsten's original question was, we have frogs that settle into metal pots in our backyard. Are they intentionally choosing these pots because they make their calls so much louder? And she did say that. She said that there was this echo that came from them. They seem to be so much louder than the terracotta pots that were in the backyard. What's the verdict, Carl?
Well, at the time, we didn't know. And I was quite open saying I've got no idea because I'm not a herpetologist. And all the herpetologists, they're people who deal with reptiles and frogs. Apparently, they were all rolling their eyes and a few of them sent me emails and one came from Emma. And my colleague who did her PhD in frog reproduction said it was obvious. everybody in the world, everybody knows this, that the male frogs flock to the loudest pots to amplify their croaks to the ladies.
Oh.
It's all about loving another frog very much in a special way to make babies. And by the way, it's really hard to, they just threw this in just to show their herpetologist. With regard to getting sperm, it's very easy to get sperm from a horse, incredibly difficult to get it from a male frog. I don't know what you can do with this information, but that was one thing. And then for our third finish of the year, hay fever can be fixed in some cases, by desensitization therapy, which I didn't know.
So we've gotten a lot of questions about hay fever this year.
Yeah.
Tell us about this therapy.
So it's similar to the therapy with regard to peanut allergy, where you give them exposure to peanuts at an early age and you gradually increase the dose. In this case, when you've been an adult for a while and you've got this stupid hay fever that gets you every year, with some people, not all of them, you can do the desensitization therapy. You find out what the pollen is in their territory and then you expose them to a tiny amount and then you gradually increase it. And for some people, it just changes their life so much. It doesn't work for everybody, but it does work for some people. So if you're one of those poor people who have hay fever, it is possible you might get relief from desensitization therapy.
We've gotten into a lot of topics this year. If you want to add some more to the pile, now is the time. The final live episode of Science with Dr. Carl for 2025. Dane in Point Cook, you are kicking us off. So tell us about your parents, yourself. What's your question?
Hey, doctors. How you going?
Good to go. Welcome.
Hey, so yeah, my question is, parents, sister, black, brown hair, green, brown eyes, right-handed, wear glasses, tan really well. Then there's me with red hair, blue eyes, no glasses, left-handed, burn under a light globe. What's the go?
Burn under a light globe. I love that phrase. Okay, so with the red-headed one, that's fairly easy. Red hair is recessive, so there could be this red hair gene in both your parents and their line going back for a long way, and you just have to have the right bits of DNA mixing. So you could, in fact, be the first red-headed person in the family for generations. That's no big deal. With the black hair, in the same way that evolution is not perfect but just good enough, genetics is probabilistic. You get a mix of what you get from the different parents, and then it gets even messier. We're discovering more and more hybrid people. And I quoted a few weeks ago the case of a woman going for a kidney transplant who was not related to two of her three children because when she was being manufactured in my favourite organ, the uterus, she had a twin sister. And the twin sister had different DNA and got absorbed into her, so only one person got born. So some of her eggs were that woman's eggs and some were her sister's eggs. And in the same way, it could happen with sperm. So there could be hybrid trays going back through time. And then also we've gone looking at it again. And just 2 weeks ago I was reading how they looked at a man in his 60s and they found all sorts of changes in his DNA. And he was not hybrid, but his DNA had changed over time. And now they're going looking at younger people. So the DNA that you've got is not like a blueprint that's locked in for solid, like, for example, the old-fashioned CD. The old-fashioned CD, you get a bit of glass, you hit it with a laser, you burn bits in it, it's fixed. It's more like a memory stick, a USB memory stick that you can rewrite along the way. And so maybe when your parents, before your parents manufactured you, the sperm and the egg that got together had been rewritten.
Oh, okay.
So that's definite maybe.
Definite maybe. Yep. Thanks, Dane.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Andy in Armidale, you got a question about atoms.
G'day, doctors. How are we going?
Pretty keen.
My daughter wants to ask this question, but is way too shy to ask it and has asked me to. If atoms can't touch each other, why do we have the sensation of touch?
Because the electron clouds repel each other and they cause this action at a distance. And a good example of that is if you get two bar magnets and you put the north poles or the south poles together, mate, they won't touch. You push one magnet and the other magnet retreats from it. So you're getting action at a distance. In this case, the action that happens at a distance is some distortion of membranes, of links of molecules in, for example, what are called Merkel cells. There's a whole bunch of nerve cells that respond to touch. And there's different types of touch. There's heavy touch. There's light touch, there's vibrating touch, there's sharp touch, there's dull touch. So as an example, with regard to the difference between sharp and dull touch, one way to diagnose somebody with relatively advanced type 2 diabetes is to get a sharp needle and go pom, 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 don't draw blood, and just work your way down their leg. And at some stage they say, I don't feel anything. So those nerves that used to respond to being deformed no longer do, having been damaged by the high glucose levels. So what happens is that the electron clouds are pushing on each other, and then distorting the nerve endings, which then give you, in your brain, the sensation of touch.
So it's our brain tricking us. And so how, when, let's say we get punched or like a cricket ball hits you in the belly or something like that, what is happening on the inside? Is it just there's not enough space and things are getting compressed as a reaction?
Yeah, it's the old action at a distance again. And at the moment, several militaries in the world, the Americans, the Chinese, the Russians and the British and a few others, are working on rail guns. And normally, in the military, they have a phrase like, hey, boss, are we going kinetic? what that means, you're going to throw particles at somebody like bullets and kill them, right? But going kinetic is the polite phrase, going kinetic. And the way you normally go kinetic is you have some sort of chemical that turns into a gas and it goes one way and the particle goes the other way. But they're using rail guns where it's maybe a meter or two long and you have magnetic fields. And the magnetic fields can accelerate this particle, usually of metal, to travel at 2 or 3 or 4 kilometers a second, and there's no touch involved. In the same way, when a punch hits you, there's no touching of the electrons, but definitely the force gets transmitted.
Well, there you go. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Andy. Can you play that back to your daughter?
I absolutely will.
And, the podcast?
And how old is your daughter? Is she at school yet?
12, just first day of school holidays today.
Okay, well, go to drcarl.com and make a booking and I'll talk to her school for free next year, and I do this every Wednesday afternoon, so make a booking. Costs you nothing.
Would love to.
Thanks, Andy. We've got April in Crookwell. April, you got a question about mosquitoes. What happened with your dogs last night?
Yeah, so hi, doctor. So I just had a quick question in regards to why I got absolutely demolished by mozzies last night. And my four dogs weren't fazed at all. Obviously, dogs can feel itchy and bitey, but, yeah, they never seem to be fazed by mozzies, but humans are. Mm.
They do get bitten by the mozzies. I've spoken to a few vets about this, especially the vets who train the dogs. And there's two factors as to why they don't register it so much. And number one is they're just smaller than us. And the main thing that attracts a mosquito is the fact that there's an animal that has blood. Female mosquito wants that blood to get the proteins to make babies. And we humans are much more heavy or massive than a dog. So the first factor is that we are just putting out much more carbon dioxide, so we're much more attractive as a target. Secondly, they've got all this fur, and that just makes it hard. And the mozzie is going in, going bounce, bounce, bounce. I'm getting out of here. I'll go for an easy target where there's no fur in the way. But definitely dogs can get bitten by mosquitoes, and they do get mosquito-borne diseases. And I think the mosquito still holds the record for being the most dangerous predator on Earth, because it kills more humans than any other human, mainly through malaria. And it kills more humans than any other creature.
Wow, super interesting. Well, thank you, doctors.
Thanks, April. And we got Garrick in Geraldton. Garrick, what's your question?
Good morning, doctors. Happy Thursday. Congratulations on another awesome year of science.
Aww, thanks, Garrick. Oh,
thank you. You say the nicest thing, Dr. Garrick.
So my question came to me while I was drinking a spicy margarita at the pub with my wife.
Spicy?
Yeah, a bit of chili around the edge and infused in the alcohol.
Hang on, I have never had a spicy margarita.
Spicy marg?
Spicy marg?
Definitely got to try it. Have a go.
Why didn't I get the email that this thing existed? For me, the cocktail is the high point of Western civilization, if there is any.
I said this earlier, definitely. You do like a cocktail.
I love a cocktail. Oh my God, a spicy marg, I'm in there. Okay, right, so spicy marg.
Give it a go for sure. So my question is about, you know, what happens at the other end? You know, why do we have capsaicin receptors in our bum?
Ah, the ring of fire. Is there
any kind of, is that just a terrible joke, or is it like some sort of evolutionary advantage?
In general, capsaicin is not bad for you. So on your tongue, you've got heat receptors called TVRP, which is type something, transient receptor potential vanilloid receptors. There's a V in there as well for vanilloid. I don't know why. And on one hand, if they get hit by temperatures between 43 and 52 degrees C, I seem to remember, they say, I'm having hotness on my tongue. I don't like it. This is bad. Stop doing it. And so they're a warning. But they're also activated by a bit of acid and certain chemicals such as capsaicin. Now, when you have the capsaicin, you don't just have the pure capsaicin. You have other things with it. So in addition to the heat, you get the other flavors, but underlying it all is the fact that you're overheating. Why do you have them at the other end? On one hand, birds do not have them. And birds, we think, have gone down this evolutionary pathway so they can eat something really hot and spread it somewhere else. Whereas humans have it as a protective thing. But I don't understand why you don't have it at the top end rather than at the bottom end, because at this stage you've already eaten that capsaicin, It's gone into your gut, it's gone into your blood supply, it's well and truly through your body if it's harmful. And why tell you on the way out that it's dangerous? And I don't know the answer to that. If there's an evolutionary biologist, can you please ring in? And I think that the easy way out is just to say, I don't know, because evolution is not perfect, just good enough. That's a really weak answer. Please ring in, evolutionary biologist.
Well, we were thinking possibly, you know, could it be that maybe once upon a time our ancestors might have been wiping our bums with something, and then, hey, you know, that might be a reason to want to know what's on that leaf. That's not a good leaf. Don't do that anymore kind of deal.
Oh, my God. On my triumphal wedding tour of Europe, we stopped at the side of the road to wipe our to use the bathroom at the side of the road, which was just the hiding in the bushes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my daughters ran across and used a nettle.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. It was so bad.
Oh.
But I do like your reasoning there, that it was to keep away from those if you're using bushes to clean your nether regions, to be delicate about it.
Best ideas come from pub talk, don't they?
I love that idea. Right. And the, what do I call it, a spicy marg.
Spicy marg.
So I just say, oh, I have a couple of spicy margs, thanks.
Yeah, don't know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, my God, I'm
going to
be so cool tonight.
Thanks, do yourself Garrick. A favour.
Yes,
thank
absolutely.
You.
Macy in Melbourne, what's been going on with your jewellery?
Hi, doctors. My question is, why is my jewellery turning my skin black? So I'm actually a jeweller and I made the ring, so I know what it's made from, and I've had them for years. But recently, in the last couple of weeks, maybe month or so, when I wear them to work and then take them off, my hands are black, and it doesn't happen with all my rings, just the yellow gold.
Wow. So you're in a profession that goes back some 40,000 years to the ancient Neanderthals.
Yes, I'm pretty fortunate.
Wow. And how do you train to be a jeweler?
I did an apprenticeship, so 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you say yellow gold, what does that mean? Does that mean 14 carat or 18? Or I believe that 24 is 100% gold. Is that correct?
Yeah. So they've been alloyed down. So some of them are 14 carat and the other one is 9 carat. But like I said, on my other hand, I wear a platinum ring and another ring that's been rhodium plated, which is dipping it in a solution which covers it in like a really thin layer of white gold. And I don't have a reaction on that hand.
Hang on, is white gold gold that's been coated with rhodium, or is it can be just any metal coated with rhodium?
So you can rhodium plate any metals, but white gold is different from, I guess, a yellow gold or from being rhodium plated.
But it has atoms of gold in it.
Yes, correct.
And by the way, my boss, the head of the School of Physics, she was part of a team that discovered that when two neutron stars ran into each other back in 2018, they made a volume of gold equal to 10,000 times the volume of planet Earth.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So now, have these, firstly, a question about the gold, the jewellery, have they changed? Do they have a coating that's broken off or cracked? Are there any changes to them?
All of them, the ones that are turning my hand black, are solid yellow gold. They haven't been changed, rhodium, or altered in any way. What I was speculating it could be is a change in my either deodorant that I'm wearing with some aluminium reacting. But I was also thinking, because when I get ready for work, I have them on the sink, is that perhaps it's the hairspray and it's the dry shampoo and it's the deodorant, I don't know, going onto them and the particles are reacting?
True.
Well, people actually did an experiment last week and I've sent them a couple of books and the Triple J sent them for doing the experiment. So you could do the experiment and write it down, but I'm thinking along your pathway, certainly the stainless steel might be part of it, and the way you could tell that, go around that is by using glass, or it could also be changes in you. Unfortunately, we do get older at the rate of 1 second per second.
Yes.
And there could be changes in the type of medications you're taking. I've got no idea of those. Or the shampoos, the deodorants, the shampoos can be volumizing. There could be new habits. There could be new cleaners that you're using around the house. I'm reckoning it's almost certainly-ish one of those. It could be the stainless steel as well. And the way around that would be to, as I said, write it down.
Okay.
And so you could then do this experiment over the Christmas holidays and you could be our first recipient of the 2026, whatever fancy is about that number, I don't know yet, 2026 Triple J Lucky Dip Prize.
Oh, that sounds great. But just a quick one, Dr. Carl. Let's say if it was, for example, the deodorant, could it be the particles that are going onto the jewelry directly, or could it be the jewelry reacting with it in contact with my skin?
Oh, so it's a three-way reaction. You do get those three-way reactions happening. So, for example, with regard to ozone, in the atmosphere being destroyed by the CFCs in the old days, you had to have a third party, which were called the polar stratospheric clouds. So it could be that this is a three-way party. You've got to have that extra ingredient to make it happen. You can have a lot of fun working this out and to win your pack, your fun pack in the new year.
Yeah, sounds like I've got quite a bit of work to do.
We're giving you homework there. Sorry.
Macy, someone's actually texted in saying, my 9-carat gold went black on my skin when I was menstruating.
Wow.
Oh, okay. Now, so I don't want to get into your cycle, but could that potentially have something to do with it?
That'd be, and if only they'd written it down and then sent photographs as well.
So many variables.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that Macy, one, but of course, it's a big one.
Very interesting. Thanks for telling us about it.
Thank you very much, Macy.
Thanks, Dr.
From you in the new year, Dr. Macy, with your homework done.
Happy New Year. Mac in Wollongong, you got a great hypothetical. What's going on? Talk us through it.
So whenever I'm driving and you have like the little, oh, first of all, hello, doctors. You have the kilometer range on your car of like how much longer you have till you run out of petrol. If I'm, so usually I have about 10 kilometers on it and the servos say, you know, 10 kilometers away. Am I better off driving slow? So say doing 80 kilometers instead of 100 kilometers and using less fuel per kilometer. Or am I better driving fast so I get to the servo quicker, but I'm using more literage per kilometre? Which one is better?
The first one. So do you know, so this is a petrol engine or a diesel engine, I'm guessing?
Yeah, petrol engine.
Okay, so do you know about the torque and horsepower curves?
No.
Okay, so the engine can start off running at zero revs, and it just doesn't like it. It will run somewhere, say, it'll idle around 1,000 revs, and then there's two different things that the engine can generate. It's torque and horsepower. And torque is the ability to twist the shaft, and horsepower is how quickly you can do that twisting. I think I've got it right. The torque curve is different from the horsepower curve. The torque curve in a modern engine, is your car a few years old?
No, it's pretty new, fairly new.
Okay, so the torque curve might reach its peak at around 3,000 revs and then begin to tail off, whereas the horsepower curve will reach its peak at around 6,000 revs and begin to tail off. And if you're racing a car to get the fastest acceleration, you take it up to peak torque and you take it up to then peak horsepower, say from 3,000 to say 6,000 revs, and then you change gear and it drops down to peak torque again. And so then you're at 3,000 revs, you go up to 6. The point is that the engine has these different characteristics, and where you'll get your greatest economy is when you're driving at peak torque. So you want to drive at the slowest speed where you're getting maximum torque, say around 3,000 revs. The faster you go, the wind resistance increases, not just by linear, not just by squared or cubed, but I think it's somewhere between cubed and fourth. So if you double the speed, you increase the wind resistance by double, not just twice or four, but probably eight times. And there was a famous case of a car, the Jaguar XK150 or the Jaguar E-Type, and they advertised it being able to do 150 kilometres an hour. It would only do that if they took the number plate off. Having the number plate on reduced the top speed by about 4 kilometres an hour, by 4 miles per hour. So you would definitely don't go for the fastest speed. Try to drive at the slowest legal speed where you're on peak torque, which I'm guessing it'd be about 3,000 revs for your engine on average, 2,000, 3,000.
Right. So next time I'm fuel lights on, hook it into the left lane and just trot along until I get to the servo.
Yeah, or you could always fill it up more soon than 10 kilometres from empty. Was that, you just like risk, man. You like living on the edge, man. Yeah. You're wild, man.
Wants the adrenaline. Thanks, man.
Always. Thank you.
And we got Andy in Wangaratta. What did you see the other day, Andy?
Hi, doctors. I saw in the garden that we've got some bees that are blue.
Blue bees?
Yeah, blue bees. So we were talking and we were wondering why some animals are blue.
It's to do with, firstly, just random noise of the universe and their environment, and being able to remain invisible if they're prey or a predator. They don't want to be seen. Plus, you've got to scale that against the effect of heat and cold in their environment. So if they're in a dark, if they're in a cold environment, on one hand, they want to be as dark as possible to pick up as much heat as they can. And on the other hand, polar bears are white. And the reason they're white is that they're invisible. So they've evolved down a pathway where you can't see them because they're all white. And polar bears have been seen sneaking up on people with their paws covering their black nose. So it's a mixture of all those evolutionary pressures. And the blue can come from various causes. It can come from dyes, or it can come from scales where you've got the atoms arranged in lattices. And there's another factor as well, is that they can see ultraviolet. So many insects can see not just down to blue and violet, but they can see ultraviolet, the stuff that causes skin cancer, and many flowers look totally different. So it's a combination of wanting to remain invisible to what's trying to kill them, or invisible to what they're trying to kill. A whole complicated issues there. Once again, where's my favourite evolutionary biologist?
Where's Zoe Keane? We need Zoe Keane on
Zoe
to tell
again.
Us.
Yes. Okay, that's the best answer I can give because I'm not an evolutionary biologist.
No, that's a great answer. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Andy. Josh in Newey. Josh, what's your question?
Yeah, good morning, doctors. Hope you can hear me over the sound of the wood chipper.
Oh, right, okay.
Just at work. In the line of work, I came across some couple of baby ravens. Unfortunately, the tree had to come down and I was raising them at home. Unfortunately, my parents weren't too thrilled with them flying around and pecking at the antennas and bits and pieces on the roof. So I had to move them on. But there was a story from Germany a little while ago where they were pecking the livers out of toads. They found that these toads were just blowing up. And when they looked into it, that's like they thought it was fungus. They thought it was bacteria. Ended up being these ravens just surgically removing their livers. And I was wondering, would we be able to train our ravens here to remove the livers of cane toads have a biological pest control?
Ravens are incredibly clever. They're related to that whole corvid family, and Aesop, A-E-S-O-P, a few thousand years ago in Greece, had the famous tale, which was actually observed in the wild. We've seen this happen, where you get a raven or a crow, same sort of family, and you give them a bottle of water. And there's water in there, and they shove their beak in, and their beak sort of expands as it gets further from the tip, and it can't get to the water. And then the raven or the crow will turn around. We've seen this in real life. Look around, find some stones, pick them up and put them in the bottle of water and lift the water level up. They are clever creatures. They've got a very small brain, but it's wired differently from ours, and it can also rewire itself on the run. The second part of the answer comes from the movie Rush, where Niki Lauda, his car's broken down and people have recognised him and they say, hey, drive the car for us. And then his girlfriend-to-be says, why are you driving like an old man so conservatively if you are really a famous Formula One driver? And he says, well, the risk-benefit analysis shows me that there is no benefit to be got by driving fast. I will drive safely and slowly because that way I'm less likely to have an accident. And then she says, stop doing that, do it for me. And then he immediately scares them by driving fast and they have a wonderful time. So what's in it for the raven? So the ravens have already got a good life. We'd have to firstly let them know that there's all these frogs there, these toads, and the trick that they have to do is avoid the poison glands on the back of the neck. And they're already doing this. They flip the toads over onto their back where I forget what the poison gland is called, but there's a chemical that'll come to me in a minute, and they go into the soft belly and they eat the livers, which are really high in food. Little diversion here. So orcas they're killer whales, which are really dolphins, they will attack sharks and go only for the liver. The liver makes up 20% of the weight of the great white shark, and it's just full of nutrients. So what we've got to let them know is, hey, ravens, if you go for the liver of these cane toads, when they're on their back, you'll get a really nice meal. The thing is, how do we let them know it's in their benefit, thinking about why should I drive fast when because it's lots of fun but it's more risky? How can we do that? We need a an animal trainer. Don't know.
Potentially.
There's people who train dogs and animals, and there's somewhere we've got to let them know that there's a huge advantage in them for going for this soft target because they can swoop down from above, land in front of the cane toad, flip it on its back, and then just eat the liver. Lots of nutrition. Yeah. But we've got to convince them. How do we do that?
Not sure. Josh, thanks for your question.
They'll figure it out. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you. That's good, Josh.
Thank you. Ethan in Swan Hill. Dr. Ethan, what's your question?
G'day, doctors. My question is, when you need to go to the toilet to do a number two, but you hang on to it and it disappears for a whole day, where does it go?
It doesn't go back up further, but the stretch receptors get desensitized. There's a different thing that also is in another factor involved, which is that there's a small amount of piano accordion activity. If you think about the old-fashioned piano accordion, it's got these slats, and as you pull it apart, it expands. So there are piano accordion-like slats on the bellies of the whales that do the filter feeding. And so the fin whale can see a whole bunch of krill ahead of it, and it will open its mouth at right angles and dive for the krill, and it will more than double its weight. The whole belly will expand. It'll go, this 60-ton animal will take on 70 tons of water, and it will expand. There's a reasonable amount of that piano accordion-like expansion going on in the bladder, but less so in the bowel. So I think you could possibly shove it back. I actually did do gastroenterology, which was one of my favourite subjects when I was a medical doctor, but I didn't ask my bosses about this. So if there's any gastroenterologists, please ring on 0439-757-555.
Yes, oh my God. Got it. But yeah. Ethan, know the feeling.
I'm thinking it's a combination of the stretch receptors backing off and saying, oh, I'll give you a couple more goes. So with your bladder, you get about two or three goes before you just gotta go. And but you can't hold it back a whole day, can you?
I can hang on for a fair while.
Well,
sometimes you go, Dr. Carl.
For Australian workers.
Yeah. Ethan, thanks for your question.
Thank you, Ethan.
Thank you.
James in Orange, what's your question?
Yeah, g'day, doctors. my question is, we've got a few wind farms and that popping up around the joint here. Do the wind towers reduce wind from using the energy of the wind, or do they create wind working like a fan?
They reduce the energy in the wind. So wind is created by a combination of two factors. Firstly, the sun, when it is directly overhead, delivers half a kilowatt of heat to the ground. The air warms up. The ground warms up, the air warms up, it rises, and then you got the rotation of the Earth, and then a whole bunch of local factors kick in. There's things called Hadley cells. Look up in Wikipedia, polar cells, et cetera, et cetera. So the wind is created initially by the sun. Secondly, the wind energy is reduced. You take energy out of the wind. You are taking energy out of the wind, and this can affect wind farms further downstream. A friend of mine, Tom Barber, helped put up the first wind farms in the USA. Time for the throat coat. On the Jolimon Pass in Los Angeles. And the way he worked out the wind was just getting a kite, and he had a little spring tension in it, in the cord, and he observed that it was pulling at so many pounds, because that was the USA, and he worked out where the best places to put the towers were, and he put the towers up, and then suddenly one of the towers stopped spinning, and they worked out by going backwards, because he had maps of where the wind was, that a tree had grown an extra metre, and it was about 400 metres away. So there are definite downstream effects. You are reducing the wind velocity further downstream, and that could affect a wind farm further downstream as well. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for that. Yeah.
But the energy comes from the sun.
Thanks, free. James. Thank you. Jules in Canberra, you got a question about yawning.
Hi, doctors. Yeah, I do. So a few years ago, well, over a decade now, something happened and I stopped being able to finish my yawns. I don't know, just like a switch flipped.
Wow.
Yeah, so I can start my earwoms, I get the urge, but I never get that satisfaction. Mm. And so it just drops off. And so I just keep yawning and yawning and, you know, just keep starting it because I feel like it. But it never finishes until I forget about it. My question was, how does, like, what kind of muscles are affected when you yawn? Because I haven't had one in over a decade.
You say that when you ignore it, the yawn finishes? Do you end up accidentally doing a full stretchy yawn? No.
I tried ignoring it, not thinking. It just peters away. So I've never gotten the satisfaction from a yawn. In over a decade. Because that never comes, I just want to keep yawning because the urge is still there. I stop wanting to yawn after maybe half an hour when I get distracted.
This happened to newsreader Jack James when he got his tonsils out.
What?
Yeah, wasn't able to yawn thereafter.
He had his tonsils taken out?
Mm.
So I wanted to know which muscles are involved in case I can like train them or something like that so I can get my yawns back.
Well, you've got a bunch of muscles around your jaw, the masseter muscle and the temporal muscle, in your temple, way up high in your skull, that's part of it, and the pterygoid muscles. You got muscles in your neck, the sternocleidomastoid, that's the one that makes up the web of your neck going from your shoulder halfway up to your back of the ear. And then your diaphragm muscles are an important part of that. And the intercostals, the muscles between the ribs, they kick in as well. And then also the muscles in the pharynx and the larynx, which is in that air pathway. And so you're saying that this newsreader, after they had their tonsils out, could no longer yawn.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, at one hand, we've got the yawn center in the brain. And on the other hand, it tells the yawn muscles to work. So maybe the muscles have been damaged or gone to sleep. Trying to work out which muscles are involved, you have to find one of the few yawn doctors in the world. There's not many.
So, Jules, to be clear, you still get the urge to yawn, but you just can't complete it.
Absolutely. So I'll start trying to yawn, and then it'll just disappear. It'll just drop off like a cliff.
Oh, my God. And do you get the desire to stretch your arms at the same time as you yawn?
In the old days? I think back in the day I did. Nowadays, not anymore.
There's a fancy word for that called pandiculation. So it's either your yawn center has decreased in activity or some of the muscles have weakened with time, as with the terrible case of the newsreader. I don't know. Come on forward, yawn scientists. Please ring in and let us know.
Yeah, I'd love to get in touch with them.
Oh, you poor thing. I'm so sympathetic.
Thanks, Jules. Our last question for the Science Hour for 2025.
Hooray! Thank you.
Oh.
I win.
She wins. She wins Science with Dr. Carl for the year.
It's a cardboard model.
Thank you so much for such a fantastic year. We've had a great one.
We've had such a lovely year, and I've learned so much from the audience along the way, especially how frogs want to attract the ladies and they find the loudest, most resonant bucket or tin or pot to get inside. I had no idea that they were that clever.
We did our first live show as well, Science with Dr. Carl Live at the Enmore Theatre. Completely sold out. Who knows? Maybe we can.
And how many views on Insta?
Well, we've gotten on one of our Instagram videos over 50 million views.
50?
Yeah.
Last I heard it was 16.
Yeah. We're 50 going million. Crazy, babe. Yes.
That was as many questions as I could answer in 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm. One or two.
Oh, my God. That was so brilliant of you to come up with our idea. You fully rock, Dr. Lucy.
Thank you so much. The full video and our show is up for you on Triple J's YouTube channel. Science with Dr. Carl will be back in 2026. Dr. Carl, I'll see you then.
Peachy keen, catch you then, mate.
And that's it. Thanks so much for listening to this last episode of Science with Dr. Carl for 2025. But we do have some special little gifts to tide you over during the festive season. You're going to get some best of highlights from the year that was. And we've also got Dr. Carl tucking into the science of lyrics, songs that are also eligible for the hottest 100 of 2025. So if you're yet to vote, get voting. Thanks again for being a part of the Science with Dr. Carl fam, for sending in your questions, for liking, subscribing, sharing, and hanging out with us every single week right here on the podcast. Dr. Carl will be back with you again in 2026. My name is Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Ella Carter and Matteo Bascarin, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.